Hey, it's Bill Simmons. Very excited to announce the newest podcast to the Ringer Podcast Network family. It's Against All Odds with Cousin Sal. So this pod is gambling, 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 and more gambling.
Yes, I have a gambling problem, and I want to share it with you. I want to make it your problem.
And it's not just football.
NHL playoffs, NBA playoffs, baseball, horse racing, there's boxing, UFC.
When we hit SummerSlam.
Oh, all the wrestling. When we hit July, we have a hot dog eating contest for Nathan's.
And some surprise celebrity guests.
Yeah.
All right. It's Against All Odds with Cousin Sal. Subscribe to it wherever you listen to your podcast. And we're thinking about once a week, right?
Yeah, let's do it.
And welcome to the Ringer MLB show. And for once, finally, I am your host, Michael Bauman. I'm a staff writer at theringer.com. I'm joined by my colleague, Ben Lindberg. Ben, how are you doing?
Hello. There's no correlation between host and intro. I would say that we are both always co-hosts, regardless of who's doing the intro. But just in time for your big debut as the intro deliverer, you have developed some sort of infection here that is affecting your voice.
I left the house last weekend. I went to the ballpark to
it's always dangerous.
To talk to people and like touched handrails, and I'm almost certain that's how I got this cold. So now I've got this good Jim Brockmeyer baritone as opposed to my normal Tina Fey making fun of somebody from Philadelphia voice that I usually have going. So we're going to talk about the Manny Machado saga, and we're going to bring in our history expert, Stephen Goldman, to trace, I don't know, fights, violence in baseball, grudges, however you describe it through the years.
Evolution or lack thereof of baseball brawls throughout the years.
Yeah. So just to reset the clock, on Friday, April 21st, Manny Machado overslid the bag trying to break up a double play. He spiked, almost certainly by accident, Dustin Pedroia, who missed a couple games. And then 2 days later, Eduardo Rodriguez threw at Machado around waist level and missed three times, which is troubling for Eduardo Rodriguez's ability to hit a target, if nothing else. In the later innings of that game, Matt Barnes came in and tried to put one in Machado's ear hole and missed again, probably to everybody's benefit. So there was much finger wagging, and Barnes was suspended. And then we come back and there's more barking as the teams get back together. And Dylan Bundy hits Mookie Betts in the first game of their series. I don't know. I feel like that was an accident, if a little bit poorly timed. So Tuesday night, Chris Sale throws behind Machado again, and then Manny Machado gives just a phenomenal post-game interview that in which he broke new ground in smarmy legacy media reporters talking about how they can't repeat profanity on their on their platform, and says that he has no recourse and the Red Sox are throwing at him and this will just never end. So
and now that we've caught you up, we are out of time. So thank you for joining us today. Yes, it takes a long time even to summarize. So from time to time, as we have on a couple of previous episodes, we like to bring in our friend Stephen Goldman, who is a writer for FanRag and Vice Sports, formerly of Baseball Prospectus and SB Nation and other places, to give us a historical perspective on current events, because almost everything that happens in baseball, if not in life, has happened before. And
you can go full Battlestar Galactica on that, Ben. I don't think our listeners will mind.
Sure. It's all happened before. So Steve knows about more of those things than we do. So we bring him on to try to bring up some of those old recollections and see how they apply to the current day. Hello, Steve.
Hey, how are you?
All right. So when you read about Machado getting thrown at repeatedly and Machado coming out with his comments about the Red Sox, and what distinguished this situation, I guess, from a lot of situations like this, and it's fairly common, obviously, for there to be this sort of dust up, but there seemed to be kind of a team-wide condemnation on Machado's part, where he was passing judgment on the entire Red Sox roster, and in turn, they were essentially doing the same to him by throwing at him so many times. So did this bring to mind any previous examples, any baseball grudges of the past?
Well, there have always been things like that. But what's interesting is that normally no one really gets hurt or doesn't get hurt in a severe way, and it doesn't escalate to this level, at least not in real time. I mean, Paul O'Neill came up under Lou Piniella with the Reds and didn't get along with him. And then when O'Neill was with the Yankees and Piniella was managing the Seattle Mariners, there was always this undercurrent that there was a hostility there. But if you look at the records, Paul O'Neill was hit by the Mariners exactly once in his entire career. So maybe they were throwing high and tight, but somehow they managed to miss him all those times and it never really erupted into anything. There were times, particularly in the 30s, 40s, 50s, when these things did break out into actual brawls, and there were consequences for that. And the problem was that baseball didn't take it all that seriously. So guys didn't get ejected for those things. They get fined. They might get suspended a couple of days, but these things simmered on and on. And one thing that came up when we were discussing this off the air with John Thorne, he mentioned an incident involving Davey Williams of the Giants. And that's a really good example of the way that these things simmer. So and it takes kind of a big picture to see it. But what happens is if you pull back the camera, Leo Durocher goes from managing the Brooklyn Dodgers to managing the New York Giants. These teams have had rivalries going back to the beginning of the 20th century. And when Durocher goes over there, it's one thing to have Durocher as your manager when he's ordering beanballs and takeout slides on somebody else, and another thing when he's on the other side of the field and he's ordering them on you. And it was pretty clear that he was doing that. And the Giants had Sal Magley, who was known as the barber, not because he liked to cut hair, but because he liked to cut heads with baseballs. And after Jackie Robinson and various other Dodgers were thrown at a number of times, he came up with a brilliant plan. And what's neat about this brilliant plan is that you read accounts of this kind of thing being attempted in the careers of Ty Cobb, in all the dead ball era guys, and it never seems to work. And if anybody tries to execute it now, maybe it doesn't work now either. Certainly, I've never seen it. It might be because guys don't bunt anymore. But the brilliant plan is you drag a bunt up the first baseline, the first baseman comes into field, the pitcher has to cover, and when the pitcher goes across the bag to take the throw, you kill him. You spike him, you run into him, you knock him into foul territory, and somehow this never, ever happens. And it didn't happen for Jackie Robinson, who, by the way, did. I mean, and this, I think it would be naive to say that it wasn't a racial thing for him. It wasn't just the Giants and Dodgers rivalry. It was league-wide. He was a human pincushion. He got hit by a ton of pitches. So I don't mean to diminish the memory of a great man by saying he's making this petty gesture. It might have been one of the few gestures he could make. But in this case, it plays into that rivalry. So Magley's on the mound. He drags the bunt. And Magley doesn't cover. The second baseman, a kid named Davey Williams, covers. And because the rivalry is so bitter, Robinson says, I might as well go through with it. After the game, he made a snide comment like, well, if I had tried to avoid him, I might have pulled a muscle. Well, he pulled all of the second baseman, Davey Williams' muscles. And although Davey Williams tried to play for the rest of that season, his career was just over. He had sustained back injuries and other problems that made him ineffective as a major league from that time on. And all the Dodgers, and this is in the newspaper reports after the fact, and you can find it in books, you can find it anywhere, were congratulating Jackie, hugging him, high-fiving him for this incredibly great gesture that he had made. Sal Magley used to say, if he buzzed a batter with the ball, because you can't definitively know intent on the part of the pitcher, and we're talking about that even now with Chris Sale and Machado, he would say, the ball slipped. And after Jackie killed Davey Williams, one of the Dodgers coaches, the future Hall of Famer, Billy Herman, came up to Jackie and he said, it's funny how the ball stopped slipping after you killed that guy. So, it's not a good look for anybody, but that's what these teams had going on. And not, you know, the rivalry was all kinds of, you know, you would think that because Durocher had been the manager for these guys, because he had been there right up through his year-long suspension in 1947 and had stood up for Jackie Robinson before going over the Giants, that there would be some kind of sentimentality there, some kind of, he's not that bad. But no, they knew he was that bad. And it went right up to the managers, because the Dodgers manager was Chuck Dressen, who had been kind of the boo-boo to Leo Durocher's Yogi Bear for decades and wanted to prove that this is a very strange analogy, but he was the Yogi Bear. And so, you know, this bitterness just went all the way up and down. It went into the front office and they just kept kind of repeating these rituals.
So there have been numerous books written about that Dodgers-Giants rivalry and Durocher's role in it, but also, like, you get in a 154 game schedule with only seven opponents in the league, I imagine you play these guys more often in addition to being in the same city. So like you said that they might have had a soft spot for DeRocher because he was their manager. I don't know that DeRocher was the kind of manager that you'd have a soft spot for. Like he'd go over to the other side and you'd know exactly how nasty he was.
No, that's absolutely right. I mean, DeRocher was for DeRocher. I was thinking about this because somewhere in this discussion, Billy Martin has to come up. And before we got on the air here, I was asking myself about the differences between DeRocher and Billy Martin, who were kind of versions of the same guy. And I think the difference was that DeRocher was very, very sane, kind of like a Jack Larson character. He was the ultimate narcissist, and maybe not in a clinical way, but in a just like, this is survival of the fittest. I don't give a damn about you as long as I get through this experience. Billy Martin, I think, was insane. And so he had vendettas. He had things that had nothing to do with survival, but had to do with revenge. Leo DeRocher was just out to kill you because that was going to keep Leo DeRocher alive and his career successful and ongoing. So you're absolutely right. There was no benefit to that. One of the great lines, and I hope I don't mangle this, but Dick Young, the sports writer, had this hypothetical, like you and Leo DeRocher in a life raft. He falls overboard and a shark comes to eat him and you jump in and save him and the shark chews off your leg. The next day, you and Leo start out even.
Did players have to hide the animosity less than they do today? Not that Machado was exactly mincing his words if you read the unedited transcript, but because the league, as you mentioned, is maybe a little more observant about policing this sort of thing today, although hardly as observant as it could be, or frankly, as it probably should be. But you can get suspended for saying, yeah, I was trying to hit that guy. Do you have any idea when that became the case? Was there a more lawless time when you could openly say what you were doing?
Yeah, absolutely. It was certainly up through the 50s. When, again, you might get suspended for a couple of days or have kind of a cash thing, you know, cash taken away from you. But for example, one guy who comes up, and this is where Billy Martin is going to enter into our discussion, is a catcher who played in the 50s and early 60s named Clint Courtney. And before I tell you about Clint Courtney, I will say that he was a guy who got into repeated fights, and not just with Billy Martin, although they had kind of a special thing going, but with everybody. And you would think a guy like that, who just habitually gets into fights, who has a problem, basically, would, you know, his punishments would escalate as he goes through each of these incidents. But they didn't. And on one occasion, the president of the American League, and this is after a number of fights, you know, fined him $100. He had gotten, he was with the Browns and the Senators most of his career after starting out with the Yankees. And he got into a fight with the Tigers. And the league sent him a letter saying, hey, you know, you caused this brawl. You've been fined $100. And we would really like you to reconsider the way that you carry yourself. I mean, it wasn't even like, I mean, if you go back to Babe Ruth, right? When Babe Ruth got into fights with umpires and went into the stands and threw sand in their faces and things like that, he got letters from Ban Johnson that said, like, I really doubt that you can tie your own shoes. You're such a wreck. I'm paraphrasing, but it was incredibly personal. And I think Ben Johnson said something like, it is long since past time for you to allow the light of reason to enter your diseased mind. And, you know, and in this case, Clint Courtney is just getting we really wish you'd reconsider your behavior because it's inconvenient. You know, it's just a slap on the wrist. So I want to tell you about this guy though, because the great mm-hmm. thing about him is that he had this habit. He first of all, he's a great guy to think of because one of the fun things about baseball is lists. And one of my favorite lists to make repetitive, maybe I have a problem where I should let the light of reason into my mind, is the number of catchers that got deflected by the Yankees because Yogi Berra was just an immovable object for like 15 years. And some of those guys became stars, like Sherm Lawler and Gus Triandos became multiple time all-stars for other teams because, you know, one of the big things about Yogi Berra is he never came out of the lineup. So it's not like somebody else got 80 games in one year when he broke his leg. He just had this incredible durability for a catcher. And Clint Courtney was another guy who could not displace Yogi Berra. And he wasn't an all-star like Lawler, like Triandos. What he was a guy from Louisiana. He was the first catcher to wear glasses. And I don't know if it was because of that, but he had a massive chip on his shoulder. And he just got into fights where on the field, off the field, like he didn't like the way you were playing ping pong with him or the way you looked at him or whatever. He would take a swing at you. And he and Billy Martin had played against each other in the minor leagues and then were in the Yankee system together and had this longtime animosity. And this is my favorite thing about it, that he keeps getting the worst of it. So there are two really famous brawls that he had with the Yankees that we can talk about that escalated into big things. So, for example, on July 12th, 1952, in that game, Courtney is on first base. He's reached base. Billy Martin is playing second. And Yogi Berra, for whatever reason, has a momentary brain freeze. One of these things that's, when it happens, is always amazing to see, where in the middle of an at-bat, he turns to argue balls and strikes with the umpire. Time has not been called. So Courtney goes to steal second base. Berra somehow wakes up, throws the ball down, maybe because Courtney is a catcher. The throw beats him easily, and Billy Martin tags him in the face. Some reports say between the eyes, some say in the mouth. That's the third out of the inning. Billy Martin starts jogging off the field, but he hears footsteps behind him. They sound ominous. So he whirls around and starts pounding on Clint Courtney. They start scrapping on the ground. They knock down two umpires as they go, you know, pinwheeling around the infield. Other players are running onto the field. They're trying to pull the two guys apart. They can't. Only Courtney gets ejected. He gets suspended. He gets fined. He gets suspended 5 games and $100. Billy Martin gets to keep playing, by the way. Not that Billy Martin was certainly immune from suspensions in his career. He had many. But on this case, he was just, you know, considered the innocent party. And I want to point this out because I will pay this off in a moment. Courtney's glasses got bent, which is serious stuff. So less than a year later, April 28th, 1953, the Yankees are playing the Browns in St. Louis. And again, now they've seen this guy a lot. As Michael pointed out, you play these guys over and over again, so there's no time really for things to cool off. Yeah. The game is tied late, 6-6 in the top of the 10th. Gil McDougall doubles. There's an intentional walk, and I should say Courtney is the catcher. And now there's a tapper back to the mound. And McDougall decides, and I don't know whether this was a pointed decision or not, but I want you to think about this in terms of antagonism, that he's going to score from second base on a tapper back to the mound. In other words, he's going to keep running no matter what. So, And the play is going 1-4 because there's a runner on first. So the pitcher is going to pick up the ball, throw to second to get the force. McDougal goes, that's what happens. McDougal goes tearing around third. The ball beats him to the plate by about 6 miles. He rams into Courtney. Courtney goes sprawling. McDougal scores because he drops the ball. The official scorer charges Courtney with an error. This is how life is for Clint Courtney. So he, and how often do you see this? To invoke a baseball cliche, how often do you see a guy get absolutely murdered at the plate and then he leads off the next inning? So it's the top of the 10th. And Courtney goes to the plate, turns to Yogi Berra and says, "Someone will pay." He leads off with a long single to the outfield. And even before, how often do you see this? Even before he makes the turn at first base, everybody's running onto the field. They know what's going to happen. The outfielders are coming in. Like, I don't know what happened to the ball. I just know that by the time he got to second base, everybody was already there. All of them Yankees, because it's them who are on the field. You have to think of, again, the strategy that goes into this sometimes is, and we could talk about Ben Chapman, who used to run into the opposing team's dugout. I mean, it's not smart if you think about it, because there are like 20 guys in the opposing team's dugout. They all have bats. That's really not the safest place to go. Anyway, he goes flying, spikes first into second base. He cuts Phil Rizzuto in a couple of places. Phil Rizzuto is not a guy you want to cut. He was not just a veteran Yankee, but he was, because he was short, because he was lovable and cuddly and represented the money store even then, for all I know. He was somebody that everybody looked out for. So he goes flying in. All the Yankees are already there. Allie Reynolds, who's the big pitcher, grabs Courtney, pins his arms behind his back, and guess who? Billy Martin is there to use him as a punching bag since he can't fight back. The outfielder, Bob Serve, and this is why I mentioned the glasses, politely removes them from Clint Courtney's face and steps on them. Again, who gets suspended? There are fines for a bunch of people, but it's Clint Courtney. It's all Clint Courtney's fault. There was a 17-minute delay. fans start throwing bottles. The umpires threaten to forfeit the game. Marty Marion, who's managing the Browns, has to go out in the field and say, please stop so we can finish losing to the Yankees, which they ultimately did, which they usually did. And eventually they moved to Baltimore, which is where we get Manny Machado. So it's all one long scheme is what I'm trying to say to you guys. Somehow, because this game happened, Manny Machado happened. But you know, it's usually it's more like Paul O'Neill, where a guy just kind of after the game goes, those bastards, they were throwing at me. They don't respect me, blah, 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 blah. But in this case, it escalated to actual violence.
Yeah. So maybe we should just suspend Clint Courtney every time something happens today. He won't mind.
Well, he's long dead. So.
Yes, right. So can't hurt anyone. Speaking of the O's and Red Sox saga, it has continued even since we started talking, this will all be in the past for people listening, but maybe it'll be fun for them to hear us react in real time. We waited for Machado's first plate appearance to happen. We're recording on Wednesday night thinking that there might be further developments, and it passed without incident. He struck out looking and all seemed to be well. And then leading off the second inning for the Red Sox, Xander Bogaerts got hit by a Kevin Gausman slider, and Gausman got thrown out of the game, even though there was no one on and it seemed very much to be intentional. And people are arguing about it and mad at it, and the saga continues. So it just goes on and on and on. But it was a 77 mile per hour pitch. So I guess if you have to get hit by one, that is the way to do it.
That's why I wasn't surprised when you said, and as you said, we're doing this in as the game is happening in real time. I wasn't surprised that Machado was not thrown at, because he's the second batter of the whole game. They're at Fenway Park. It's the top of the first. If Drew Pomeranz throws at him there, it's so transparent that not only is he going to be ejected and the Red Sox are going to lose his services for the day after all of two outs, but they're also, Joe Torre is going to throw the book at him and they might lose him for a couple of starts. So it's something where if they're going to do it, you think it would be more subtle to do it with some reliever who's more dispensable for the next week or 10 days.
Like they did last week, or like they tried to, at least.
Yeah, there hasn't been that much subtlety to this whole story, really. But yeah, you'd think so. So I think what sets this Machado case apart is that it's continuing for so long, and it just seems to every game there's a new development, and usually these things get resolved pretty quickly, even if there's a bad brawl or something. I mean, maybe you see the team later on in the year and people talk about, oh, is something going to happen? And usually it doesn't. These things are usually confined even to a single series.
There was that A's Royals thing a couple years ago, and the Rangers Blue Jays last year. But generally this is over in a day or two.
In the older days, they had other ways of resolving it. They weren't always public. One of the things that tended to happen was teams might share a train out of town. Mm. And if you had a brawl on the field, you might conclude it in the dining car or the observation car. Or similarly, there are famous baseball brawls that no one saw, including Billy Martin actually fought Jimmy Pearsall under the stands. Casey Stengel and Leo Durocher, when one was a manager and one was still a player, when Casey was still a manager and Durocher was still a shortstop, got into a famous fight, again, under the stands. You know, just meet me after the game. And somewhere in one of those tunnels, they fight it out. There was an umpire who threatened to take on a whole team of John McGraw Giants, and they pounded him into the floor, and everybody was suspended. Yeah, the umpire, the players. But again, that's something that the public didn't see. And that's good, because, you know, I mentioned Ben Chapman before, and I mentioned the bottle throwing with the Clint Courtney, who probably will be suspended for tonight's actions, I think, the Clint Courtney incident at Sportsman's Park in St. Louis. But there was a rolling series of fights between the Yankees and the Washington Senators in the early 30s that revolved around Ben Chapman, but also involved other players. That in 1932, there was a play at the plate where the right fielder Carl Reynolds slid into Bill Dickey, and they had been hitting Bill Dickey a lot. I don't mean with pitches, but in terms of plays at the plate. And Bill Dickey had decided he wasn't going to take that anymore. And when he got knocked sprawling this time, he just got up. And when he heard Reynolds coming up behind him, thinking Reynolds was going to hit him, he jumped up and shattered Carl Reynolds' jaw with his fist. And Dickey was suspended at first, basically forever. It was just like, he's gone. It's an open-ended suspension. And then they cut it down to, I think, 30 days. And he had to pay a lot of money, like a significant fraction of his salary for that year in terms of fines. Carl Rowlands ends up with his jaw wired shut. Not very long after that, he nearly choked to death on his own vomit. Because as it turns out, if you're going to throw up with your jaw wired shut, I don't know how much your listeners really want to know about this, but it's not pretty to think about, but there's really nowhere for it to go. So somebody had to get some wire cutters before he suffocated. He was never the same player. You know, I mean, there's no knowing why, but it was a traumatic incident. And those kinds of tensions continued. So the next year, there was a situation where Ben Chapman, who was a really good player for a while, today we kind of remember him as a character, an antagonist for Jackie Robinson, and deservedly so. He was the guy who, the one person in all of baseball who was too racist to continue, essentially, when Jackie Robinson came on. But and as a player, he was the same guy. He would talk about there being too many Jews in the stands at Yankee Stadium and fun, endearing things like that. But he was kind of a miniature Ty Cobb, both in his performance and in his personality. And in this series with the Senators, he just kept sliding into Buddy Meyer, the second baseman, over and over again. And finally, when they threw at him, he went into the dugout. And everybody, notably except Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig, who were too smart for this stuff, apparently, they came out onto the field. There were fights everywhere, not just Chapman and whoever, but any two Senators and Yankees were fighting. Fans started streaming out. Cops had to come in. There were multiple arrests. I mean, these kinds of things, we don't think of it happening that way anymore. But in any situation where you do have uncontrolled violence, people can get carried away. They suddenly decide that they're part of the action. And, you know, you don't want an Orioles fan deciding that Manny Machado's honor must be avenged and, you know, come flying out of the stands and pounding on Dustin Pedroia. But we've seen those kinds of things happen.
So I don't know if this is jumping ahead too far, but Machado talked about, you know, his lack of having any recourse when pitchers are throwing at them. And he alluded to, he said something along the lines of, you know, they keep throwing balls at me. Well, you know, all I have is my bat or something like that, which immediately I don't think it was a threat so much as him just illustrating that he has no way of defending himself. But it immediately conjured up images of Johnny Roseborough and Juan Marichal. And I don't know if this is jumping too far ahead in time, but was that a watershed moment, or was that just so shocking? Like, even then, a throwback to this era of like the 40s and 50s where there were fights all the time. Because I think that's one of those anecdotes from baseball history where we all just sort of accept that it happened without, you know, taking the time to go back and marvel that like a guy hit a catcher over the head with a bat in the middle of the game.
No, I think it was shocking even then. And for everything that has happened in baseball history, with the possible exception of Carl Mays hitting Ray Chapman, and that was one of those situations where you really can't know intention, and chances are there was no intention. Carl Mays did have a reputation as a headhunter, but all the circumstantial evidence says that Ray Chapman kind of ducked into the pitch, and obviously he wasn't intending to kill him, but he died. Other than that, I don't think there's anything more shocking, really, than the Johnny Roseborough thing, because you're seeing a guy with his head bleeding on the field because somebody else assaulted him with an implement of play that was suddenly transformed into a deadly weapon. However, it happened again. You know, I mean, the one incident that you didn't mention came in the playoffs when in 1972, when the A's shortstop, Bert Campanaris, I'm blanking on who did it to, but he helicoptered his bat or hammer threw his bat at the pitcher after he was hit. And that led to a 10-game suspension. He was suspended for 3 playoff games, which is a huge thing if you think about it, to take a regular out of a playoff team's lineup, and then 7 regular season games the following season. So it does happen every now and again. There's a famous incident with the pitcher Pedro Ramos where he hit a batter. I'm trying to think of who the batter was. And he ran like, essentially, once the batter came after him with the bat, he then ran like hell, which is not the bravest thing, although he was famous for being a very fast man for a pitcher. And he reemerged from the clubhouse. He ran all the way to the clubhouse off the field and then reemerged carrying a knife. And I mean, people really can, when pushed really hard, they can bend and break psychologically. And I guess that's what happened for Juan Marichal at that time. I think it's what happened for Bert Campanaris, who no one ever had any complaints about. None of these guys were Clint Courtney types where, you know, you're walking around daring people to fight you. These are regular players and very skilled players. And then for whatever reason, whatever provocation, they lose it.
Yeah, there's even the Johnny Cueto kick of Jason LaRue, or multiple kicks in that brawl in whenever it was, 2010, that ended LaRue's career. And Cueto was sort of pressed up against the netting, and I don't know whether it was instinctively or not, just lashed out like that. It's not even really something that we think about all that often. And Cueto's sort of a likable player and a fun player to watch otherwise. So he hasn't seemed to really pay for that in any sense other than maybe his own personal guilt.
Well, first of all, let me correct the record on one thing. I said it was not Pedro Ramos. It was Ruben Gomez. And the guy that he dusted was Joe Adcock, after which when Joe Adcock went after him, he again ran like hell. Second, if I don't know about you in terms of you mentioned these incidents with kicking, but one that I think about, I have to admit, kind of obsessively, and, you know, I'm falling asleep at night, and for whatever reason, this filters into my mind, was, I believe, a Rangers-Indians game in 1986, in which Dave Stewart, late general manager of the Arizona Diamondbacks, by late, I mean deservedly former, dusted Julio Franco, and in response, Julio Franco didn't do anything, but Indians manager Pat Corrales went out to the mound and tried to kick Dave Stewart, who then cold cocked him. And his comment, which it would be, I suppose, politically incorrect now, but I've never stopped thinking about this line, was he said of Pat Corrales, he's a woman. So times have changed, obviously, but it seemed at the time in context sort of a very pointed put down.
Particularly when you're talking about someone you've just, you know, punched out.
who ran out to the mound and tried to kick you. I don't know. Maybe I think Pat Corrales had a black belt or something. So, I mean, maybe there was that he was just reacting on instinct, but it wasn't kind of a, you know, normal baseball behavior.
Is it more or less likely for there to be animosity between players today, even if it's not expressed in quite as brutal a way as it might have been before? But a lot of things are different. You mentioned, of course, taking a train together. Travel doesn't happen together anymore. But there's also so much media coverage, so much scrutiny from fans and writers and the league itself, and everyone is rich, so maybe they don't have quite as much to fight for if they're all millionaires for the most part. Maybe they're all just generally in a better mood. I don't know if that's the case. And another thing, I guess, is just that the schedule has changed such that there are more players and more teams and more games, and you're not playing the same players over and over again. You're playing interleague schedule, of course, throughout the year. So,
and the teams change more and more.
Right.
Too.
There's like so much turnover. You've probably played with a lot of the people on the other side of the field. Maybe that wasn't quite as often the case in the past. So much has changed. Do you think that these sort of flare-ups and dust-ups and serious brawls, as opposed to just the run-in from the bullpen and mill about for a bit, are less common today than they were?
Yeah, I think one of the things that's interesting is I've come to hate the phrase unwritten rules, because it's an all-purpose excuse for things, but they never do seem to go away. And the fact that they're unwritten hardly stops anybody from exploiting them very publicly and very rigidly. And despite the fact that when you think about these games that we've been talking about, right, I know about them, these things that happened before I was born or you were born, from newspaper accounts and from things that people have written after the fact. But nobody was at these games, especially today. And I've written about this many times, that for all the glory that we accord guys in the Hall of Fame from that, from those old days, you know, Babe Ruth and Walter Johnson, Lou Gehrig and all that, the attendance was so much smaller. The country was smaller, obviously, but attendance was also so much smaller. They played only day games. People still had to work for a living back then. So if Babe Ruth had a three home run day, maybe 4,000 people saw it. And then X number more people, many more people, picked it up in the newspaper, but nobody actually saw it happen. So when we talk about these fights and these brawls and everything in the pre-television era, even the pre-radio era, they were just distant rumors to you. They were things that you heard about. Now we have all this scrutiny. We have, thanks to MLB Advanced Media and the option to watch every single game, whether on cable or on the computer, You can see every instant of it. It goes on social media. It's repeated endlessly. You can embed it in a tweet. You know this stuff. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't stop anybody. So I wonder what you're thinking. If, say, you're Chris Sale the other night, and first of all, you've had this incident at Fenway Park where you had the Orioles center fielder, Adam Jones, having these racist things chanted at them, which is not a good look for your city. It doesn't necessarily reflect on the team, but then you go and you throw at a guy who's of Dominican ancestry, and it just, like, one thing after another, like, it's just not a good look. And yet, and we know that Chris Sale has a temper. He's the guy with the scissors for the uniforms and everything, but it doesn't stop anybody. This is not like an Agatha Christie locked room mystery where no one was in the room when the maid poisoned the Lord so-and-so with the strychnine and whatever. Like, everybody's watching, and yet mm-hmm. they do it anyway. So in some ways, the exposure is so much vastly more. As I said before, if you didn't want Judge Landis or Will Harridge or whoever was running things back then to throw the book at you, you could take Leo Durocher under the stands and pound the snot out of him. And nobody would say anything except maybe Leo Durocher's mom. I don't know. He was very close to his mother. Everybody has that side to them. But, you know, today you are just not going to get away from it. And when you have pitchers can still say that the ball slipped, but when you have this kind of context, it's just very, very odd.
Yeah. And it's funny, there are these moments where it becomes clear what you're watching and the violence of the situation is sort of laid bare. Because often, even in this conversation, you'll describe one of these situations and I'll kind of chuckle, like, oh, those silly baseball players from the black and white days and their fisticuffs. But, you know, it's not something that would be amusing in any different context, but when it happens on a baseball field with these lovable characters, you can kind of romanticize it. And there are these moments, and we've talked about a few of them, where it just cuts through that veneer and it's just sort of exposed as, you know, these people are actually hitting each other with things that could harm or even kill them. And that's not really funny. And maybe we should do something to stop that. But for whatever reason, because there's such a...
But not the Red Sox and Orioles right now. No. We shouldn't stop this at all.
Well, it's a 4-game series, so we can't yet. But yeah, it's just for some reason, I guess because of the weight of tradition, I don't know that the arc of baseball bends toward justice even as quickly as society at large, which isn't all that quick sometimes.
I think distance gives us a little bit of inoculation against the pain. You know, I was thinking, we were talking about Ben Chapman before and all the fights that he got into and all the things that he said, both before and after the Jackie Robinson situation marked his life for forever. And in 1934 and 1935, in spring training, he was actually going around to his teammates on the Yankees and saying, I will bet you any amount of money that I will not get run out of a game this year for trying to kill an umpire. And nobody would take the bet. And, you know, he went up to Lou Gehrig and he said, you know, I will bet you $50 that I will not get thrown out of a game this year for being a red ass. And Lou Gehrig said no. And you'd think that Lou Gehrig was famously cheap, by the way. You'd think maybe that was why he said no. But Chapman asked him why. And Gehrig said, too easy, just too easy. And that's funny, right? We laugh at that, but it's scary. It's a guy who, and this is a guy who got traded out of New York for that reason and went on an odyssey through the majors before he winds up managing the Phillies. He's a guy who really wanted to play, even pitched during World War II when the major league regulars had been taken for soldiers. He came back as a pitcher on the Dodgers, and it costs you, you know, whereas if you see other players who are known as good guys and good characters, the game will make room for you for forever. It'll take care of you forever, whether you're a coach or a broadcaster or an executive, just a random advisor to the general manager, just because they like having you around. And if you do these things, you really destroy this incredible association, this fraternity that you're part of, where they don't trust you. And let me give you one other example of where this can go, how bad this can get if it's not taken care of aggressively. Because clearly this Machado situation between the Orioles and the Red Sox is simmering. And you'd think that with Pedroia actually saying, like, no, I didn't ask them to do that. It wasn't me. Like, you'd think that would just end it. Like, the pitchers would say, like, okay, he doesn't want us to do it. We're not going to do it. Like, not our problem. In 1968, this is much closer to the present day, there were some series between the Tigers and the White Sox, where there were a lot of hit by pitches. I think the White Sox hit something like 8 Tigers in 3 games, and there was a lot of bad blood. So the next series, when they played Tommy John of future Yankees fame, future Dodgers fame, future Tommy John surgery fame, started against the Tigers. And when Tommy John threw it about, seemed to come inside to the Tigers infielder Dick McAuliffe on a 3-2 count, McAuliffe goes flying out to the mound, lands on Tommy John's pitching shoulder with his knee, and tears every ligament in the thing, putting him out for the year. That's before the Tommy John surgery. That was a previous surgery. And John was just, you know, as the players are brawling around him, John's not defending himself. He's not getting up. He's just lying on the ground, breathing in pain, screaming. And that was it for his season. And I'll give you 2 things about that, which is, again, these are the consequences. And just, and this is maybe a very silly point, but Tommy John is just short of 300 wins. There's his missing half season. He would be in the Hall of Fame if not for this stupid brawl in 1968.
All right. So less thought. If you think about it, we could be still in the early ages of baseball. If baseball endures for hundreds of years.
That is so optimistic.
It is.
That is, we're going to have you on again at some point, because my theory is we won't be playing baseball by the year 2100.
I hope I'm here. Also totally possible.
If not sooner.
But let's say that baseball continues, that the United States continues, the game spreads, whatever. Let's say that it's too ingrained to become extinct as every other game does eventually. So we fast forward, I don't know, a few centuries. And at that point, Clint Courtney and Mike Trout are indistinguishable from each other, right? They're both players who played in the old days, and you can look up their stats, but no one remembers them. They're all just faded in the past. What do you think the people of the, I don't know, the Federation of Planets era are thinking? The baseball fans in that day, and we know from watching Star Trek that they're still out there, what are they thinking when they look back at some of the examples we've talked about today? What are they thinking when they look back at Chris Sale and Manny Machado? I mean, just based on your study of other areas of history, will this ever change? Or will we get to a point where we look back at even today's baseball and say that was pretty barbaric?
First of all, I just want to say to both of you that somewhere about 1913, Charles Hercules Ebbets, who was the owner of the Brooklyn Dodgers at that time, gave a speech. And sometimes from the distance of 100 years on, it's difficult to figure out why things resonated so much with people. But the keynote idea of Charles Ebbets' speech was that baseball is still in its infancy. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, that struck people as hilariously stupid. And he was a very easy guy to mock for a lot of different reasons. That's a different podcast. But there was just, you know, coast to coast laughter that Charles Ebbets thinks that baseball is still in its infancy. But he was absolutely right. If you think about, and I don't need to list them for you, all the evolutions and changes that the game has gone through since then and where we are now. So when you talk about or make fun of where, and I'm not trying to fault you, Mike, at all, because, you know, the way things are going now, I mean, we're going to have to be playing the game in underwater domes 100 years from now if we're still playing them. And then every game will be decided by those Tampa Bay rules. You know, it's off the dome and a whale caught it. And so I guess it's just going to be a ground rule double. It's off the octopus catwalk. So, I mean, you know, but we very well still might if we're around to do that. In terms of what you're asking, Ben, I think that it won't change unless people change in a very fundamental way. And I don't want to be grandiose about this, but kind of a lot of human history is reducible to very basic animal instincts about violence and reprisals, which is to say somebody bonks you over the head with a stick, so you bonk them over the head with a stick. And that's some of what Clint Courtney was, right? I mean, the difference between Clint Courtney and somebody else, between, I don't know, him and Ernie Banks, right? Let's play too. Like, great, friendly, joyous guy, and Clint Courtney, who's like, let's have a brawl, is just that there's a thinner veneer between that person psychologically and his ancestor in the primordial jungles or forests or whatever, who is clubbing people over the head and you know, grabbing their brontosaurus leg and eating it instead of letting them eat it. And so I don't know that it will ever change, because as long as people have these ideas about the way that they have to defend themselves and stand up for their honor and protect their integrity and so forth. We will always have that kind of tit for tat, eye for an eye. It's so fundamental to the way people are. And I'm sorry if that's pessimistic and cynical, but really, you know, we're just shaved apes, and baseball players are just shaved apes. And, you know, they're not, you can enforce it with as many penalties as you want, but, you know, boys will be boys and humans will be humans.
Well, on that note,
actually, on this note, you invoked Star Trek. Mm-hmm. I just looked it up. Star Trek thinks that the last World Series will be in 2042. Mm-hmm. So
can I just say that Captain Sisko was a loser? I know that's what you're referring to, Deep Space Nine, right? But the thing that drove me nuts about Captain Sisko, and this is not a baseball thing, was it? But they had this trope in every other episode that did not focus on when Captain Sisko wasn't playing with his baseball, where Captain Sisko would say, "You will absolutely not do X," to some other character. And then that character would go and do X for 45 minutes. And then at the end of the episode, he would say, "Okay, it worked out. But if you ever do that again, I will yank you back so hard." And I swear that like 9 out of 10 episodes conclude with that, like no more Mr. Nice Guy. So the baseball thing, while nice, it was anachronistic and did not redeem him for me at all.
Well, you can get Steve's thoughts on Star Trek and baseball and history on his podcast, which just recently rolled out. It's called The Infinite Inning, and he's got a couple episodes banked. You can find that at fanragsports.com/podcast. It's the baseball one, and you can also find his column there regularly and sometimes at Vice Sports, and he is also on Twitter at GoStevenGoldman. Thank you, Steve, as always.
Thank you so much for having me. I had a lot of fun.
All right. Well, I'm happy to report that Red Sox Orioles ended without any additional violence, although Adam Jones was thrown out for saying something to an umpire after striking out. Let's hope all the silliness will die down soon and that someday MLB will impose harsher penalties to discourage this sort of thing, if only for Captain Sisko's sake.
So thanks for joining us, and we'll see you again on Monday.